This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 42 years ago, as President Dwight David Eisenhower prepared to leave the White House and end a life of public service, he decided to use George Washington's farewell address as a model, an opportunity to address the nation on what concerned him most. The president spoke to a national audience on television and radio from the White House and, in a memorable phrase, warned the nation about the growth of a military-industrial complex.
Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government.
In an article in the Atlantic Monthly, James Fallows argues that the term military-industrial complex has been misunderstood over much of the last 40 years. So, what did Ike mean? What was the spiritual element he talked about? Most of you are familiar with the phrase. What does it mean to you? And we especially want to hear from those of you who work in the defense industry or in the military. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is James Fallows, national correspondent with the Atlantic Monthly. Always good to have you on the program.
Thanks very much.
And Douglas Brinkley joins us from his office in New Orleans. He's a professor of history and director of the Eisenhower Center for American Studies at the University of New Orleans. And good to have you back as well.
Good afternoon, Neil.
James Fallows, what do you think that President Eisenhower meant by that term, military-industrial complex?
It was clear in context that Eisenhower was talking mainly about the corrupting effect of so much money going through the military then. In absolute terms, in Eisenhower, at the end of Eisenhower's term, the military was spending about three-quarters as much as it does today in constant dollars, but that was a lot in GNP terms. So Eisenhower was afraid that this money was going to distort American politics. When he reflected on the spiritual aspects, he meant what it would do to the political system, what it would do to the military itself to have so much money. Interestingly, this isn't the way we came to think of the term military-industrial complex in a decade after that, but that was the original connotation.
Well, how did it come to be misunderstood?
I think that during the Vietnam years in particular, if there was a person who seemed to exemplify the military-industrial complex, it was this man, General Curtis LeMay, who throughout his career, starting with overseeing the bombing raids on Japan in World War II and through his time as head of the Strategic Air Command, illustrated the idea that we really should be about to go to war at any given time. And if you remember the Oliver Stone film JFK, the whole plot line there was that the reason John Kennedy had to be killed is that the Vietnam War had to happen because the military wanted it to happen. And there was a sense that the military-industrial complex meant skewing American foreign policy towards war, which is something different from what Eisenhower was arguing. Interestingly, the real effect of Vietnam on the military has been to give it a sort of anti-war bias, as we can discuss later on. But I think that during the novel 7 Days in May was about a military coup to make the U.S. more bellicose.
Mm-hmm. Douglas Brinkley, obviously you're an Eisenhower historian, and I wonder, what do you think that President Eisenhower meant by that phrase?
Well, I agree, first off, with what James just said, but to amplify it a little more, you have to keep in mind a few things. First, Eisenhower was an Army general, and we all know what he did at D-Day and in World War II, but every Sunday he would have to sign the death certificate for any soldier in the European theater, and he'd put on music, sit by himself, and it would just ravage him to have to sign all these dead bodies. Eisenhower also, of course, went to see the concentration camps after World War II. He understood the ravages of war. He may have been a military man, but he was not a war hawk. He was somebody who thought his job as president was to avert war at all costs, and he, of course, got America out of the Korean War, and he wanted to make, he realized America had to have the strongest defense in the world, but he didn't think it should come at the cost of education and other social programs. And, you know, during those 8 years as president, Eisenhower approved many new military initiatives. He's the person who initiated the funding for the Minuteman intercontinental ballistic missile, Polaris nuclear missile, firing submarine, on and on. He created NASA, for example. But he did not think that we should always approve every bomb and plane or new bit of military technology that came down the pike. And he rejected the Nike Zeus anti missile, which caused a great deal of anger from congressmen and senators from states where they had large military concerns, like Washington and Missouri. And Eisenhower feared that this was starting to become, you would be somehow unpatriotic if you were a president, and shot down some sort of new bit of military hardware. And it started gnawing on him, particularly by 58, because Stuart Symington and the Democrats started saying that Eisenhower was weak on defense, that there was a missile gap, that we were losing the Cold War to the Soviets under Eisenhower's lame leadership. And all of these feelings came to a forefront in the famous farewell address. And he had purposely read George Washington's farewell. He had a couple of crack speechwriters work on it. And he knew very well what he wanted to say in that, but he was never realized that the term industrial military complex would have been lifted out of it. And incidentally, originally the term in the original draft of the speech was military industrial scientific complex, but his science advisor James Killian convinced him to shorten it to the now famous phrase military-industrial complex.
Jim Fallows, he was talking about the Nike Zeus program, which was, in retrospect, one of the wackier ideas of shooting down incoming ballistic missiles with atomic weapons, I think before they totally understood electromagnetic pulse, among other things. But anyway, Douglas Brinkley was talking about, I mean, you can see parallels to that in the Crusader weapon that was just canceled by Donald Rumsfeld, and all the protests that came out that said, we need absolutely this huge piece of mobile artillery.
Right. And you can also see parallels at all sorts of levels. There's the political level, too, where there's been the weird spectacle in the last year, not simply of Max Cleland, you know, the amputee Vietnam veteran being cast as weak on defense in his own failed re-election campaign, but within the councils of the Bush administration, having the main voice for restraint in Iraq be General Colin Powell, the most experienced military man in the administration, which is sort of a continuation of the Eisenhower heritage that Douglas Brinkley was mentioning.
Well, yesterday we received an email from a man named Cliff Williams who wrote us, "I thought you might be interested in knowing that my father was Eisenhower's speechwriter for the military-industrial complex section of his farewell address. As a military officer, his specialty was military policy. His name is Ralph Williams." Well, thanks to Cliff Williams for giving us his dad's phone number, and we called him at his home in Falls Church, Virginia. And Captain Williams, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
What was your role in writing this speech?
Well, I was assisting Malcolm Moose, who was the president's chief speechwriter, and idea dates back to a meeting that Moose and I had in his office on October the 30th, and I have a memorandum to that effect, that what our discussions were, and at that point, why it was in the memo, it says war industrial complex, which later evolved into military industrial complex. But that the whole idea of this discussion, that the military industrial complex originally was to be part of the president's State of the Union message in the following January. And as things went along, it began to appear that the State of the Union message was usually just a recitation of past accomplishments and future aspirations, and that perhaps we should make a special speech for the things that the president really wanted to say to the American people as he left his office.
When you and Mr. Moose were thinking about this, did you look at each other and say, "Military industrial complex"? Boy, what that's a zinc! Boy, what a great phrase that is.
Well, no. As a matter of fact, we were surprised. At least I was, and I continue to be amazed at all the attention it's been getting over the years.
Can I? This is Doug Brinkley. I just wanted to jump in.
Surely.
I have the memo of October 31st.
You do.
That Captain Williams, who's then, you were then, of course, in the U.S. Navy.
Yes, right.
Wrote, and it says, here's your language.
Uh-huh.
The problem of militarism, this is Williams to Eisenhower.
Yes.
The problem of militarism, for the first time in its history, the United States has a permanent war-based industry. Not only that, but flag and general officers retiring at an early age take positions in the war-based industrial complex, shaping its decisions and guiding the direction of its tremendous thrust. We must be very careful to ensure that the merchants of death do not come to dictate national policy. I always found that a very, very strong worded comment, and of course from that, some of that language evolved into the farewell address.
Yes, it all comes back to me now. I hadn't seen the memo in several years, and now I remember it.
Captain Williams, this is Jim Fallows. I'm relieved to say that in my article I credit both you and Mr. Moose for this phrase, but as a former White House speechwriter myself, it's both a delight to talk to you, and also I've had this question for a long time. It's been debated among the White House speechwriters fraternity whose phrase this actually is, and is it a joint Williams-Moose phrase? Is it a Williams phrase? Is it a Moose phrase? Where does this famous phrase really belong?
Well, as I say, it grew out of a conference that I had with Moose, I could not really say attribute it to either one of us solely. It's just something that came out of the meeting, and I went back and wrote up the memo, and that's the way it's been.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate it. Retired Captain Ralph Williams on the line with us from his home in Falls Church, Virginia, a man who helped write the phrase, the military-industrial complex. Well, wanted to get listeners involved. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk to Gary, who's with us from Tacoma, Washington.
Well, hey, Neil, thank you very, very much. Gentlemen, the military-industrial complex. You have no idea how many times I've used that phrase in my different political rantings and ravings over the years. I want to give Captain Williams accolades for coming up with that and the Merchants of Death. I think he was at that time right on the money, and I believe today in 2003 we're reaping the harvest of the military-industrial complex. The idea that we never got off of our war base, the idea that the two biggest businesses that move money and energy in the world are drugs and arms, and oftentimes the arms are used to control the drugs, which are used to buy the arms. It's a shame that one of those very battles goes on inside the walls of our country, our war on drugs. I'd like to see this all change for the better in my lifetime. I don't know whether it ever will, but I just think the term military-industrial complex as coined and used by Ike is just fantastic. I think this show is amazing, and I hope we rip the scab off the military-industrial complex today. Gentlemen, let's be very candid. Thank you very much.
Well, Gary, thanks for the call.
In connection to that call and also to Captain Williams' memo, what struck me is that what he identified, 40 years ago as the problem of this spending, which is corrupting the officer force, that is exactly the live issue in the year 2003. And so I'm struck by his prescience.
And I just want to add also, I think the term industrial military complex really got into one of the fascinating things when you track this is that it was the Nation magazine, of all things, right after the speech, that couldn't believe that was Eisenhower, and they ran a great salute to Ike in the Nation in a column by a fellow named Jerry Green. And it was the left who started adopting during the anti-war movement that phrase, and you could find it in the 60s in books by Noam Chomsky and Eugene McCarthy. They now were starting to quote the Republican Eisenhower warning of an arms industry run amok. And it really, the best place to look at it is in a book by Blanche Cook, who's better known these days as an Eleanor Roosevelt biographer. But she wrote this very important book called The Declassified Eisenhower, where she talked about how the 34th president in some ways can be seen as an anti-militarist. And what's interesting during Vietnam, Nixon was president by 69, and he went and called the whole military-industrial complex a straw man issue. That people were twisting Ike's words around.
Doug Brinkley, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Douglas Brinkley at the University of New Orleans. We'll be back with Jim Fallows after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the term military-industrial complex, introduced by Dwight Eisenhower 42 years ago, and what it means today. Our guest here in Studio 3A is James Fallows, national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. To get in on the conversation, give us a phone call. 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. The email address is totn at npr.org. And why don't we go back to the phones? Our next caller is Gary, who's with us from Memphis.
Hey, Neil, great show.
Thank you.
I have two quick questions, if you don't mind.
Sure.
The first one is, did the military-industrial complex help bring down the Berlin Wall and end the Soviet Union without a shot being fired?
Jim Fallows, hard to argue that.
Certainly, the might of the United States through the Cold War period did have that effect. And so it's just as the $400 billion defense budget we have now will help us beat Iraq whenever that war comes. So clearly, the U.S. won the Cold War largely through force of arms.
Okay. My second question, if you don't mind, if Eisenhower had a more effective industrial complex and had won the Korean War, would we be in the dilemma we have now?
In Korea, you mean?
Yeah, in Korea, yes, sir.
Okay.
I don't know that the Korean War was mainly a matter of how many resources we had to bear. It was sort of the whole world political calculation of whether it was worth an outright war with China. So I think that with a military-industrial complex one half the size we had at that time, Ike could have taken the war to China if he wanted. That wasn't the limiting factor.
But didn't his viewpoint contrast sharply with the Powell Doctrine, which we now embrace, of war?
Sure. The Powell Doctrine is very much a post-Cold War phenomenon. The idea is there are such things as sort of discretionary wars, or they're not the kind of all-engirdling world showdown the Cold War was and World War II was. So it's different historical era and different doctrines.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
If we talk about the term military-industrial complex, there's another term that's often discussed in debates about the military budget, and that is the defense-industrial base. And one of the arguments you always get, for example, if the United States is going to need nuclear submarines in the future, well, you can't stop building nuclear submarines because then the plant closes and all the workers who know all these specialized skills scatter to the four winds, and it would cost you a fortune to reconstitute that.
And I think that's a real argument. And I was reminded of that in vivid terms about a year ago. I was down in Fort Worth seeing the site where the new Joint Strike Fighter is going to be built. This is a giant mile-long factory that was first opened during World War II to make some kind of bomber. I'm not sure if it was B-24 or B-29. It's all generations of planes since then. And there is such a thing as a real industrial base. The question is whether that's the same as sort of any kind of proposal for any spending on anything. And indeed, as weapons have become individually much more expensive, the industrial base has shrunk even as the budget has grown.
Joining us now by phone from his office at Georgetown University is Donald Vandergriff. He is an assistant professor of military science there and the author of The Path to Victory, America's Army and the Revolution in Human Affairs. Major Vandergriff, that's right.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show.
Welcome. Is the military too closely tied to the defense industry?
Well, let me put it this way. The Pentagon, in my book, I say this so it's public knowledge, it resembles a big corporate headquarters, like any big corporation. And it's a place with a very large overhead where there's a lot of officers dedicated to basically two things, more money and competing with the other services and buying ever more expensive weapons, which are either untested or questionable on the battlefield, especially as we've moved from what's called a second or third generation to a fourth generation, or for layman terms, moving from a conventional to a non-conventional warfare.
We heard earlier when we were speaking with Ralph Williams in the memo that he wrote for President Eisenhower about this idea of the military-industrial complex, was one of the things he was concerned about was what we would now call the revolving door of military officers ending their careers and then going to work in the defense industry.
Yeah, that was very good. I mean, I wish I'd had that memo. I would have quoted it in my book. It was excellent. But my research for Path to Victory discovered the same thing. Perhaps as a young officer, a captain or a major, you come in to the Pentagon and you criticize something. You know that perhaps the F-22 or the Crusader or whatever is not what we need for warfare. You've been studying warfare and it's got maintenance problems, a big overhead and so forth. Well, this idealism is forgotten about when it competes with careers, and where one strike against you in an OER, an officer evaluation report, 10 or 15 years later, when you become a general or colonel, you understand all of a sudden those weapon systems become real good. So what I talk about in my book and in my briefings is we create a conflict between what is written and desired, that idealism, and what is reality, the fact that people are forced to sell out to buy into these things. Integrity and honesty, which is presented very well in another book by Robert Korn on John Boyd, continually demonstrates that point about the Pentagon.
Jim Fallows, you covered the Pentagon, wrote a book about national defense. And is this a problem? Do officers try to look ahead to a career in peacetime? And is this a sort of insidious form of corruption, if you will?
I think it is, very much as Major Vandegrift, who I know and I'm proud to call a friend, as pointed out, where you have, and I think that the situation becomes stark if you think of it this way. The vast majority of professional officers will have to retire from their chosen life's work by their mid-40s, a age that would be considered relatively young by some people. And so they have a number of years ahead of them when they have to do something else. And the brighter they are, the more ambitious they are, the more likely they are to be recruited by the defense industries. And there is some, you know, honorable work they can do in the defense industries based on their expertise. But my observation is it has a more than subtly corrupting effect when they know that is the end of the road. And I wonder if that's what Major Grant Vandegrift also has observed, you know, from his colleagues.
Exactly, Jim. I've seen the same thing. I like what John Boyd said, that men who would willingly risk their lives for their country but not for their jobs, says it well.
John Boyd, a famous fighter ace in the Korean War.
Yeah, but more so, he developed a different way and a better way to look at the art of war, and it was what he did in the post-retirement in the Pentagon, which is which needs to be studied by the outside, the government, especially for those who aspire to be leaders in this country. The risk and the sacrifices he made, as well as those around him called the acolytes, made in doing what the Constitution said we needed to do. That those are the real heroes, and they get overlooked until recently. And Jim has covered these people for a while, been a friend of them, and told their story. And Robert Corum tells the story very well. What I've done is I've looked at the personnel system and how it creates such a conflict where, on one hand, we say the desire is for integrity and moral courage, but on the other hand, we have a system that forces people to do in contradiction to what they believe.
Well, let's get the listeners back involved. Millie joins us now from Bainbridge Island in Washington.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I had two comments. First, I was stationed at the Pentagon for 3.5 years before moving out here to Bainbridge, and I'm a little put off by the comments about the lack of integrity on military officers, because I am myself a Navy commander. But that said, I worked mobilization at the Pentagon for the Navy. And so your term military-industrial complex, I took it for its very literal meaning.
I'm afraid Millie's cell phone seems to have run out of batteries.
Oh, no!
No, there. No, you're back. You're back.
Oh, geez. I hate... hopefully you heard my comment that let me turn the car around and make sure it works this way. My concern is I worked at the Pentagon, and I was responsible for mobilization plans and policy for the Navy. And so I take military-industrial complex at its very literal term.
So you, in terms of the logistical efforts in terms of mobilization?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's very business-type term in that if we have to be able to maintain the ability to go to war as a country, there are certain things that logistically we need to do, and so it creates a system that transcends the military itself and involves the community, involves business, it involves the airline industry and the rail industry. And so going to war is a concept of a nation, not a military going to war. And so it's a great saying, it's a great philosophy. And the other point to be made, I think, which is important, is during Eisenhower's time, we went from a War Department to a Defense Department, and that's a huge strategic leap. So those are my two thoughts.
Okay. Thanks very much, Millie. Drive carefully, please.
Oh, I'm parked. I don't know why the signal had gone on me. But thank you for having me.
Okay, thanks. Good idea, by the way, if you're calling on cell phones, to park the car and be safe when you're calling us. And don't turn around in the middle, even if you lose us, because that could be dangerous. I wanted to get a response to what Millie had to say. Jim Fallows?
On her point about mobilization, which I think is quite a sound point, it's one that is about to be a rubber meets the road type issue involving Iraq, because as you and I have discussed before, Neil, the National Guard and Reserve have been mobilized more or less permanently since September 11th of 2001, and there's going to be sort of manpower strain. So I think that there are logically separable issues of this long-term mobilization ability and the large-ticket spending that the military-industrial complex is usually alluding to.
Donald Vandergriff, this is a different interpretation of military-industrial complex, though.
I understand her point. And let me go back and add too that I see your point exactly. That what I say applies to the culture of the Pentagon, but it does not apply to every serving officer in the Pentagon. And many officers there, and as well as NCOs and civilians, work very hard, but it's what they're forced not to say sometimes, and they're not going to say that they lack the moral courage or it's an integrity problem, but it's shaped by the culture. That's how things are done here, basically.
And one of the things I know that Donald Vandergriff is talking about is the zero defect mentality, which after the end of the Cold War, there was a reduction in the number of officers, and anybody who had a bad mark on their record, Jim Fallows, was tended to get shuffled out.
The promotion and evaluation system in the military, which Don Vandergriff has written about, is quite amazing to anybody who's not been part of it. There are these so-called OERs, the Officer Evaluation Reports, and if you're anything short of so-called firewalled, that is, if you don't have maximum ratings in each category, essentially your career is done. And so this has the most sort of risk-averse effect on how people behave. If you think that anybody might be upset by anything you do, so you're not going to get a firewalled rating, that has a certain long-term cultural effect.
Well, Donald Vandergriff, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, and I'm glad you're covering this important issue. Have a nice day.
Have a nice day, too. Major Donald Vandergriff is the author of The Path to Victory, America's Army and the Revolution in Human Affairs, and he was with us on the line from Georgetown University in Washington, where he's assistant professor of military science. And NPR is following the news throughout the day. Here's a couple of the stories that will be on later today. President Bush has nominated Charles Pickering Sr. and 29 other candidates for federal judgeships. Pickering was voted down by the Senate Judiciary Committee last year after Democrats questioned his civil rights record. And a federal appeals court has ruled that there is enough evidence to hold Yasser Essam Hamdi, an apparent U.S. citizen, as an enemy combatant. Those stories from NPR's Don Gagne and Larry Abramson coming up later today on All Things Considered. We're talking with James Fallows of the Atlantic Monthly about the military-industrial complex, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's get back to the phones. Chris joins us now from Miami, Florida.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. By the way, I love your show, and I listen to it every day from 3 to 4.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to bring up the point of, the military complex in regards to the book of 1984, written by George Orwell, and how he had foreseen how it was divvied up into actually basically three nations, and how... Well, basically, the three points of Big Brother was ignorance is strength, slavery is freedom, and war is peace. And how I believe that the military complex is the only way to achieve peace for them is to be constantly at war to achieve peace at home.
Jim Fallows.
Interestingly, I will suggest you're reflecting sort of the previous misconception of how the military views the military-industrial complex. I remember during, the 1970s, I was reporting on the Strategic Air Command, and I believe their patch still said, peace is our profession. So you saw peace is our profession on the side of these big nuclear bombers. And there was a certain kind of cheap irony in that, in the Orwell sense. But since the Vietnam era, since the coming of the Powell Doctrine, the military itself does not want to go to war. It's been a sort of recurrence of what we were hearing earlier, sort of the Dwight Eisenhower mentality. Since the military fights the war, they don't want to be waging them. They are perfectly content instead to be buying the weapons, building, maintaining the weapons, deploying them around the world, and you could argue that this abundance of American might has, its own distorting effect on the world, but the military would rather not be at war these days. That's sort of the Curtis LeMay think, and so that part of the Orwell formulation, I think, does not exactly apply these days.
This is based on, and I forget which old Roman it was, but if you wish peace, prepare for war.
Right. Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely, but the point is that during the Cold War, and I think we still have a Cold War hangover in regards to how the military still operates. Even if it, even though it's a terrorist state or a terrorist world at this point where we never know who's going to be coming after us, in the old days we knew it was always Russia. We were always preparing for Russia as they were trying to take over, especially in their areas concerned. And I think that that's where war is peace and how the military actually sees that as actually peace within the United States in itself.
There certainly is an enormous Cold War hangover in how our military operates. The fact that we have 80,000 troops now in Asia, 80,000 in Central Europe, those are both left over from Cold War deployments. Every time you read a story about the troubled Air Force fighter, the F-22, you can think of this as a leftover of the old showdown with the Soviet Union. The F-22 was designed to penetrate the most sophisticated Soviet air defenses. Those air defenses aren't there, neither is the Soviet Union, but the F-22 sort of lumbers on, and so there's a huge kind of long-term effect of previous deployments.
Yet, as several people have pointed out, the very sophisticated technology developed to fight the Soviet Union turned out to be awfully handy when the United States did 10 years ago go to war against what some describe as the B team.
Oh yes, and certainly there have been technological breakthroughs which are phenomenal, especially the precision guided munitions, which are relatively cheap and relatively easy to maintain compared to say the F-22.
Okay, Chris, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil. Have a good day.
And you too. Let's see if we can get a quick comment from Jane, who's with us from Cordomera, California. Jane, I think, just left us. So let's go instead, and I have to hang up on that line, and punch Clayton, who's with us from Port Orchard, Washington.
Yes, how are you today?
Okay.
I have a question that I think these guys should focus on. How much of the military-industrial complex output has been sold, not to U.S. forces, but have found markets around the globe which do not defend U.S. interests, but actually create the need to increase the military-industrial complex output in the name of defense?
The answer would be some share of it has gone, but not as much.
How about putting a number on it?
Well, I can't, and I don't think anybody could.
Fighting it, what we sold to Iraq right now.
Nobody could give a number.
Well, I think that's what we really should start focusing on, is coming up with that intel and that technology rather than, you know, some very expensive, outdated aircraft.
So you're talking about the blowback of the sales overseas. I'm afraid we're running out of time in this section. Clayton, thanks very much for the call.
Sure.
We'll be back after a short break. We're talking with Jim Fallows about the term military-industrial complex. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking with James Fallows about how to define the term military-industrial complex, how it's shaped American sense of how the U.S. should approach war. In a few minutes, we're going to switch subjects and talk about the issue of war games. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN@npr.org. And let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Michael, who's with us from San Francisco.
Hello, Neil. Again, I also appreciate your show.
Oh, thanks.
I also appreciated Clayton's comments because he made one of the points that I'd hoped to make. But I have two points I would like to bring up for discussion.
Mm-hmm.
The first is the role of Lynn Cheney, Dick Cheney's wife, on the board of what's the biggest producer of weapons we have?
Lockheed Martin.
Lockheed Martin, yeah. And that's effect on the government's policy. And in addition, also the role of Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, which was created by Edward Teller, and its set of weapons designers there that are continuing to push things like the Star Wars missile defense and now its resurgence in a new missile defense, which is a solution looking for a problem in many regards.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like those two issues to be looked at as Lawrence Livermore Laboratory and the bomb designing weapons designing team there, and its role in the military industrial complex, and also the connection between Lynn Cheney and others in the Bush administration and their connection to weapons producing industry.
Well, Jim Fallows, the Lawrence Livermore, reminiscent of the original phrase that Captain Williams was telling us about earlier today, a military industrial scientific establishment.
Indeed, and the scientists have been a crucial part of the military developments. But I think in both these cases, I would, with respect, suggest that Michael's looking at symptoms rather than causes. For example, if Lynn Cheney were not on the board of Lockheed Martin, I think the administration would still be going ahead with the Joint Strike Fighter and the F-22 and other things. And so it's an illustration of connections, but I think not a real cause. Similarly, Lawrence Livermore would not be working on these strategic defense projects had the administration not made a decision to go that way, and they weren't working on them during the Clinton administration with the same pace or intensity. So I think that the scientific the labs are the objects of national policy as opposed to the real drivers of it.
Well, if you look at how Congress was fooled in the $70 billion boondoggle on the useless X-ray laser, I think you can see how those teams of weapon designers under Edward Teller drove a project that was definitely unproductive. I believe Teller knew it was unproductive, and I could explain why if we had more time.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to shoot down a space-based laser missile system from the ground, where the air gets thinner and thinner going up, than it is to shoot down upcoming missiles from in orbit. And those people knew that at the time. Congress was very upset when they realized they'd wasted $70 billion in order to keep this team of weapons designers moving along.
And I certainly would agree that Teller himself did play a role in trying to steer the national policy. But if you're talking about Lawrence Livermore and related facilities now, I think the right way to think about them is as objects of decisions made at the political level.
Have you seen Bowling for Columbine?
I have not, I regret to say, but I hope to soon.
Well, they have Lockheed Martin there in the town of Columbine, and Michael Moore interviews this official at Lockheed Martin with a big missile behind him, and saying that he sees no connection at all between the culture of violence and fear that's produced in this country and the weapon industry. It's ironic that Lockheed Martin is the site of, at Columbine, is the site of where this incident occurred. And I think this, what Moore is talking about as the culture of fear in this country, is driving a lot of the violence, and a part of that is the military-industrial complex and what it's spreading around the world.
Well, Michael, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. And one last call on this subject. Let's go to Rob, who's with us from Fort Lauderdale.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I just wanted to make the point, my reading of military-industrial complex, that Eisenhower's original intention wasn't military or anti-military to say, but that the military shouldn't have influence on the decision-making process of the executive branches of government. And I'd like to see a comment on that.
I think it is worth going. I believe you're right. He was concerned about the executive branch, but I think the words of his speech suggest it's something broader than that. And again, just to quote, the conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. So it seemed to me he was making an even broader analysis.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Rob. And James Fallows, thanks for bringing up this issue.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
James Fallows joined us here in Studio 3A. He re-examined the term military-industrial complex in a recent issue of the Atlantic Monthly.